Welcome to Poor Decisions, a podcast about craft beverages from inside the industry. Our primary focus is on wine, and often from the Midwest, but topics include other craft beverages and products. Basically, anything you can pour is fair game. I'm Brian Lesprunts. I'm the host of Poor Decisions. Here in the Fenville AVA, which is nestled just along the lake shore south of Saugatuck, Michigan, where we are in the throes of harvest. So this is going to be harvest update number 3. So this is a special format for Poor Decisions, quick snippets, audio only, that basically are kind of an update of what's happening here during the harvest. Hopefully something that we can look back on as we kind of compare different vintages as we go through the motions. This is late September, so for us, we are, you know, rapidly kind of approaching the halfway mark, maybe a little past halfway. We'll get there in just a second. So it's busy times around here as we continue to bring in fruit from not just the Fenville AVA, but we also work with fruit throughout the Lake Michigan Shore appellation, of which Fenville is technically a sub-AVA, although it predates the larger AVA. That's a topic for another day, but nonetheless, it's been a good harvest so far in terms of quality and quantity. Kind of a standard quantity harvest, but quality looks pretty good. So, you know, every year is different. You know, this year, Poor Decisions is presented by Fen Valley Consulting Services. Fen Valley Services is a specialized division of Fen Valley Vineyards dedicated to providing expert winery management and consulting services. With over 50 years of industry experience, we help farmers, winemakers, and wine marketers build successful, sustainable businesses. As a trusted winery management company, we offer customized, consultative solutions tailored to the unique needs of each client. Whether you need assistance with winery or tasting room operations, complete winemaking services, e-commerce support, or something else wine-related, our team of experts provides the experience and hands-on support needed to elevate your winery success. Learn more at www.fenvalley.com. High-level observations of this year's harvest, from our point of view, started a little bit late. You know, we were kind of behind schedule all season. It started with a relatively cool beginning of our growing season. And then when we got hot, we probably got too hot. And so we lost some of the productive growing days that we like here along the lake. Typically, Lake Michigan will keep our you know, temperatures from getting past that point where the leaves sort of shut down, which is usually mid-80s Fahrenheit, and you're not getting a lot of productive growth. So I think that kind of put us behind the eight ball a little bit in terms of the schedule. Not a crazy amount, but enough that we started maybe a week after normal. But what's happening now is we're just getting incredible weather for ripening fruit. You know, 75 degrees during the day, 50s at night, just that cool and heat cycle just really drives ripeness. And so numbers are rapidly coming up. Not only that, but because we've been so droughty along the lake shore, you know, everything's really concentrated. We did get about an inch of rain a little over a week ago. And so last week's harvest data was a little bit skewed because we saw some dilution within the berries as the vines did take up some of that water, move it into the grapes. You see this weird phenomenon where you're seeing your bricks either sometimes go down or at least not come up very far. And you're also seeing your acidity go down, which is with a very subtle pH shift. So that's a pretty good sign that you've got some water dilution happening. This week's numbers, which we will see here in a couple days, should be a little more instructive in terms of how we're going. But we think really what's going to happen is we're pretty much back on schedule. So what this means is it's just a very compressed harvest for us. When you start late and you may finish early, it just means during that time when you're picking and processing, it's just total chaos. So what's coming in? What came in the last few days since the last time we did an update? Quite a bit. A lot of different varietals. So we got some Pinot Gris from downstate. So some of our farms that are down in sort of the Water Vliet, Berrien Springs area, a little bit warmer down there usually. They're about a week ahead of us. So we brought that in. We're bringing in Pinot Gris and the Fenville AVA the week of September 29th. Chardonnay, same story. We did some of our southern vineyards with our Chardonnay from Fenville coming in this week. We did a Riesling for sparkling, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. So pick that maybe a week, 10 days ahead of what we would pick for a regular kind of still wine. A little bit lower sugars, a little bit higher acidity, a little more lighter flavors, which is what we like for a sparkling base. We brought in Muscat Antonelle, which is one of the various Muscat grapes that are grown. Canelli and orange Muscat are also pretty common. I know some folks in Michigan have Canelli in the ground. We make that typically into a dry version of a Muscat, where we have a hybrid Valvin Muscat that we'll typically use for a kind of a Moscato style. So we got some other fun stuff coming up with that grape, the Muscat Antonelle grape, that we'll talk about in another topic. We get Matt back here to talk about what he's up to there. And then lastly was a Saporavi, which is a red grape that is kind of rumored to be maybe the original wine grape. I think there's definitely a few claims to that mantle, but we just have a tiny bit of it. It's a very dark grape, so it's great for adding color. We're just going to use it, probably blend it into something. We did make it on its own last year just for fun. It was good. It was a solid wine, but we're not quite sure what we're going to do with it this year, but it did come in. It comes in early, obviously, for the red, so that's kind of a nice thing. So that's what we've been up to. It's been busy. Like I said, that's a lot of different varietals. The last week or so has been pretty crushing, no pun intended, on the pad here, with a lot of, 14, 15, 16-hour days for the team. And I've heard that around the industry, that this last couple of weeks has been really that big push of a lot of those white wine grapes made for into still wines. And for, our region, we certainly do still have more white grapes probably than red grapes in the ground, so that you're going to see this time period be the most intense usually for processing. Also, we're going to talk about this as we get into reds, but reds have a little more flexibility generally speaking, because you're doing skin contact, so you're not as concerned about timing everything out with picking versus processing. And even crushing is pretty quick versus pressing, which is very time consuming. And so for most wineries, the core of their white grape harvest is really that most intense time. That's when you're going to have your longest days and where you're really going to have to be carefully coordinating your picking versus your processing, so you don't have that fruit laying around. That's especially true of things like Pinot Gris. That is a grape that if you're making a Grigio style, especially where you're trying to keep it light, keep it really, fruit centric, but not overly intense, you've really got to watch that skin contact, because you get to a point where that skin phenolic can really affect, especially the Grigio style. You'll catch that on the back palate, the sort of lingering bitterness. It's super important that you really coordinate that picking process with what you're going to do in the production side. So that's kind of what's going on. The grape that I wanted to dive into, the way we've been doing this is having, the first thing is kind of general observations, and then we dive a little bit deeper into a grape that we picked, and then we finish up with something process related that kind of takes the this won't pour segment. So today, the grape that I picked is one that it was kind of fun to kind of dig back through the notes on, because it's a grape that, we've worked with for a super long time in Michigan. Riesling, one of the original, grapes that I think in terms of vinifera that was grown in Michigan. And certainly there's a lot of it in the ground. As we're going to talk about, it's a grape that sort of is at home here, especially in northern Michigan where it's a little bit cooler. So background in history on the Riesling grape, it is believed to have originated in the Rhine region of Germany. The reason it's not as well known is just this goes back a while. So we got records that include the Riesling grape from the 15th century. So we're going back in time a long ways when we talk about this grape. It's likely a cross of Gouillet Blanc, which was brought up before as a parent of Chardonnay. And probably a wild vine or maybe Treminer. So I'm sure some folks that really love to go into history of wine grapes might have more to say on this topic. And again, I'm actually kind of thinking about doing a separate spinoff of Poor Decisions, where we do some episodes where we really go deep into the history of some grapes, some well-known and maybe some less well-known, just to kind of, because I loved learning about the history of them, but I feel like for this format, I don't want to go too deep on that because we're really trying to talk about harvest. But it kind of gives us some jumping off points for some episodes later on over the wintertime. Back to Riesling. So it gained prominence in the 1800s. The Rheingau and Mosel started producing some really high quality wines from the Riesling grape, and that kind of put it on the map in terms of, commerce with consumers. Then German immigrants brought Riesling to lots of other cool climate regions, including the United States, of course. Started out really in upstate New York, probably was the first place that had Riesling brought over. And then, you know, it was obviously made its way to Michigan, which is where we're growing a lot of it here. Characteristics of the grape. We have a lot of experience with Riesling, so this is just more or less our observations, but they hold true with kind of what other folks are seeing as well. It's a very versatile grape. I think this is one of the things that maybe Riesling doesn't get enough credit for, its versatility. It has high acid naturally, so a pretty low pH on the juice that comes out of the Riesling grape. Just to give you some numbers, you know, most of your white wines from a cool climate are going to be in that sort of 3.0 to maybe 3.3 range, where Riesling's definitely going to be on that 3.0 side of that typically. And it also has naturally low sugar, so it's pretty hard to get Riesling over 20 bricks. Usually it kind of stalls out in that 18 to 19 brick region of the sweetness scale, which makes for a really nice base to work off of. You know, this lighter, lower sugars is going to translate into lower alcohols. Without that acidity, you're going to get a crispness that's going to come through. And so it's highly expressive of the terroir too. And terroir, you know, again, this is another topic for another day, but it's sort of like soil and climate together. A lot of people just think of it as soil, but it's really more of the environment that the grape grows in that affects how the flavors, aromatics, colors, whatnot may come out. And so Riesling has this this very, you know, expressive quality to it. So you'll see Rieslings, like we have different blocks of Riesling that we get, some off of our farm and some from some of our growing partners. And you could almost tell the block by the wine year in and year out. And that just speaks, I think, to how much the terroir can play into the way that the Riesling grape develops. It is sensitive to over-ripening in warm climates and in warm years. I've observed this myself over the last decade or more, that it can almost be a counter-cyclical grape. In other words, some of the most epic years for most of the wine grapes that we bring in would be years that Riesling just sort of does okay, you know, meaning a warmer year where everything else got fully ripened. You almost feel like Riesling gets a little overdone. And on the flip side, you get years where everything else is kind of struggling a little bit, and you'll have some just exceptional Rieslings. And I think it is that kind of love of the cooler climate that really does Riesling well in some of those seasons. That being said, you know, we are, you know, I think learning how to deal with it. So like, for example, this year, you know, it is a really warm and really dry ripening season. So in theory, this isn't really the kind of season that Riesling would shine in. So part of that is coming out, getting it harvested a little bit earlier, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. And some of it is just, you know, farming it appropriately, you know, expecting that you're probably going to get it riper than we used to. And so being aware of that. It also has the ability to be harvested as a late harvest. And we did it last year, and we'll probably be able to do it again this year. It has pretty thin skins. It gets botrytis, which is in the dry format and in limited quantities, is also known as noble rot. And noble rot or botrytis has this really unique dimension to the resulting wines. You get this almost apricot kind of quality that is a flavor that doesn't present itself naturally very often in wine grapes. And so it's a kind of a clear sign that you've had some noble rot as you go through the process. Late harvest in general, as the name applies, you're going to leave the grapes to stay out longer on the vines. But as I already mentioned, Riesling's not going to build a lot of sugar. So what happens in reality is that the grapes start to desiccate. So they start to dehydrate a bit as the vine pretty much shuts down production on the fruit. It goes into preparing for winter by building carbohydrates into its own tissue and letting the fruit just sort of hang out there. And so what happens at that point is the skins will allow some moisture transfer, and so you'll get some evaporation. You'll see the grapes start to shrivel up a bit and raisin up, and that raisining will concentrate the sugars, flavors, kind of everything. So you get this really rich style of wine that you can make if you can do a late harvest. The downside is you're playing with fire. I mean, botrytis can go from, you know, a little bit to a lot of bit real quick, depending on your weather. So it's something you've really got to watch for. You've got to make sure you've got good cluster exposure to sunlight to make sure that those berries are drying out with each, you know, day. Even with our dry environment right now without any rain, we're still getting a lot of dew, which is pretty typical this time of year. And so the earlier that sun can hit that cluster and start to dry out the dew, the better off you're going to be at keeping any disease pressure at bay, but certainly at keeping your botrytis in Riesling at a point where it's beneficial and not harmful. So in terms of winemaking, you know, minimal intervention is super common when it comes to the Riesling grape. You often see it done in steel. Neutral oak is becoming a little more common. I see quite a few Rieslings aged on some lees in a neutral barrel, which I think is a really nice way to present it. It adds some structural elements to it. And kind of that lees contact can sometimes balance out the just really crisp acidity that you get. It has a lot of age potential. This is a white wine that bucks the trend again, in that it can sit around in a bottle for quite a while. And the reason for that goes back to the pH. So that lower pH is going to allow the Riesling wine to sort of sit more gracefully in a bottle. You do tend to pick up more of the classic sort of petrol side of Riesling. Sometimes, like, you know, gasoline, diesel is a pretty common descriptor of Rieslings, especially as they age. You'll see that develop, you know, typically a couple years after it's been bottled, and then continue to develop as it ages. So some folks really like that. Some folks really don't like that. So that's one of those, it's almost like a red wine where you get to play around with the age and how the age changes the wine and how you might appreciate that or how you might not like that. That can make Rieslings kind of fun. We've opened some decade old Rieslings and been just sort of blown away by how they've aged. Riesling does have some perception issues. I'll be honest, it is one of its challenges. I talk to people literally every day about wine consumers, and it's sometimes you have to like strong arm the customer to try a dry Riesling, because even though the word dry is in the name, they just can't wrap their head around the fact that it's not sweet. And there's a reason, the market was flooded with really sweet Rieslings for a long time, especially as a lot of the boomers were coming into the wine world. And, that's what they knew. And they just immediately associate Riesling with sweet. And of course, there's a reason why a lot of Rieslings are sweet, because all that acidity can carry the sugar. And so it's a great grape to make into a sweeter style wine. But it can make a really, really nice dry wine too, as is happening a lot more. So dry Rieslings are kind of surging in the marketplace. It's helping it to, I think, really make Riesling, hit the stage with more of that premium style, which is really where it belongs. I mean, it's such a great grape to work with, and it just lends itself to so many different styles that, you know, we're pretty pretty bullish on it here in Southwest Michigan, not just at Fen Valley, but in a lot of the wineries in the Fen Valley VA. Okay, so that's kind of the first segment on Riesling. This is going to be related. So This Won't Pour, which is brought to you by our friends at Carrier Signal, is typically in our normal podcast format reserved for sort of an off topic, something that, you know, not related to wine, sort of a way to get to know the guests better, maybe promote something that we find to be sort of interesting and enlightening to us, and sort of share it with you. But for these harvest updates, I've been utilizing the the This Won't Pour segment to talk about a facet of harvest, something that a process that we do that is only really around during the harvest season. And so the This Won't Pour segment is sponsored by Carrier Signal. Carrier Signal is an IT services provider specializing in small and medium businesses with unique needs. They handle everything from technology and security assessments, cloud migration, point of sale integration, and cloud-based phone systems. Learn more at www.carriersignal.com. Today, we're going to talk about glean picking. Okay, so glean picking is a technique that's used during the harvest process. And it, what it refers to is taking off some of the fruit in a particular block or in a particular vineyard. And when I say that, obviously, there's a reason for doing this because it's a very costly operation. You wouldn't necessarily think of it this way until you're actually out picking grapes. But even with a hand harvest, which in and of itself is going to be slower than machine harvesting, you're still going to have a situation where you'd think, okay, hand harvesting, it's just, you know, the number of clusters you're picking times the number of people you have. And that's sort of how it times out. And that's true. But if you're going to go into a block and only pick some of the fruit, it actually does take quite a bit longer because you're moving a lot more. So you're physically walking more distance. The buckets that you're filling are filling slower per like linear foot. So it's a expensive proposition. So there must be a reason. And there could be several. So for example, we glean picked Riesling for sparkling this week. So I already mentioned why you might want to pick early for sparkling. But then the question is, how do you do it? And you sort of have two options. One is to just go in and say, okay, we're going to start at, you know, the west side of this block, and we want about 10 tons of fruit. So just pick everything until we hit 10 tons. And that's the most efficient way to do it. And in many cases, that is what you do, especially if you think maybe one side of the block might be heavier crop, or maybe because you've got some shading from maybe a tree line that you go, well, we're going to start there because that fruit tends to be more disease prone or less ripe. But other times you want to do a glean pick. And so in that case, what is often done is you'll prescribe either the clusters you want removed or the clusters you want saved. This is commonly done in Chardonnay for your sparkling pick too. And so what you'll do is just say, okay, for example, we want to pick to where we leave just one cluster per shoot after we've gleaned, and, or we want to leave two clusters, or we want to, take two clusters. You know, again, that's kind of how you prescribe it. And then you're also typically going to prescribe the cluster position that you want to remove. And you're usually going to remove the furthest one from the base, or furthest however many you want to take from the base. And that's because logistically it's easier to handpick that. Otherwise you're kind of going in reverse. It's kind of like trying to pull off, like, you know, play Jenga and pull the Jenga pieces from below. RO is going to be harder to take. But also the clusters closer to the base of the plant are going to be getting riper faster in theory. And so by leaving those behind, what you're doing is two things. One, you're getting the fruit you want at the time you want it. So you go in and glean pick to get something earlier, which again, often done in sparkling, sometimes even done with things like Sauvignon Blanc, where you might want to do a split pick to bring in some stuff that's got crisp acidity, but a little bit lighter, and then leave some stuff to hang longer to build some complexity. And then the stuff that you leave behind, in theory, is going to ripen a lot faster because you've left way less fruit out there, but the same amount of canopy. So that's often the reason to do it, as opposed to just picking to a number. Because obviously, if you're doing your job right and you have good, consistent leaf removal, all of your clusters are ripening about the same. And so, yes, it is true that your basil cluster will likely have a little bit different chemistry, perhaps, than the clusters that are further out, but it's pretty close, has been my experience, unless you're overcropped or, again, you're not managing the leaf removal process. And so really the real benefit to glean picking is the remaining fruit, the fruit that stays on the vine that is able to then have more leaves to ripen it. So that's the upside of all the downsides of the additional labor in picking twice, including a pretty slow pick on that glean pick. And so the upside is getting really ripe fruit. So a good example of how you might use this in real life. So you'll say Riesling, you go in and glean pick for your sparkling program early. So you get that fruit off, you leave whatever you want behind, and then that fruit is now designated as available for, say, a late harvest. So because you've left such a small crop load on the vines, you're going to have a better shot at doing a late harvest because you're going to accelerate the ripening of that fruit such that you're likely going to be going through that raisining process while your weather patterns are still favorable for such a thing. That's one way you could do it. Again, another way you could use a glean pick is something like a Sauvignon Blanc, where you'll go in and grab an early pick to get that really nice bracing acidity, and then and some of those kind of grapefruit flavors that typically come out of the Sauvignon Blanc at the beginning of its ripeness. And then you're going to come back in and pick the balance, where you're going to get a richer flavor profile and structural element that adds just another layer. And then those could be back blended together to make a really complex wine. So a lot of different techniques for doing it. And again, it comes at a real cost. So it's something that you want to weigh carefully against what your goals are for any particular vineyard or wine that you're trying to make. All right. So that's harvest update number three. As we roll our way into October here, we are on the final stretch, probably two more of these, and then we'll be wrapped for the harvest updates, and we'll get back to regularly scheduled programming of guests. And we'll probably do a few things where we sort of reflect on the harvest with some of the producers in the area and really try to get a whole kind of a well-rounded view of what happened in 2025, both from, you know, us down here in Lake Michigan Shore, Fenville, and all the way up to, you know, our folks that are up in Traverse City and Tip of the Mitt area, and then over it on the east side of the state where we've got a lot of stuff in the ground as well. So that wraps another episode of Poor Decisions. We are presented by Fen Valley and brought with IT and creative design by Carrier Signal. Please follow our show on all your favorite podcast platforms. You can also find us on social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram. To see all the places you can interact with us and submit your questions or comments, head to www.craftpoordecisions.com. Thanks for listening. Cheers.